Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. This week, we'll meet a physicist who is using a quantum computer to do natural language processing. And we'll also catch up with a marine biologist who studies how underwater sounds made by human activity affect marine organisms. This episode is sponsored by Teledyne Princeton Instrument Spectroscopy. Their isoplane system makes data collection faster while increasing data reliability due to advanced optical designs, data calibration, and integrated hard and software optimized for spectroscopy. Visit princetoninstruments.com/spectroscopy to find out more. Getting computers to understand and process human language is a huge challenge that spans the fields of linguistics, computer science, and artificial intelligence. But could quantum computers lend a hand? Recently, I chatted with a UK-based physicist who thinks so. I'm joined down the line from Oxford by Bob Kuka, who was until recently Professor of Quantum Foundations, Logic and Structures at the University of Oxford, where he built a 50-member research group in the Department of Computer Science. Now, Bob has just been appointed Chief Scientist at Cambridge Quantum Computing, or CQC, which develops quantum computing software and algorithms. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast, and congratulations on your appointment at CQC.
Hello. Welcome from Oxford.
Now, Bob, you recently led a team at Oxford and CQC that looked into how quantum computers could be used in processing natural language. Now, that's something that most humans do effortlessly, but computers really struggle. So what is natural language processing, and why is it so difficult to do using conventional computers?
So natural language processing is really any form of interacting with machines using human language. Machines are good at a lot of stuff. That's why we use them, like calculators have been used for a very long time. Computers are used for a lot of things. Machines are always not so good at things we actually have. People are actually very good at. What we do naturally, which is dealing with natural language, is something that machines have a pretty bad time doing. I can give you one example of that. So we as humans, I mean, if we don't understand the word we never heard before, we look it up in the dictionary. Then again, if we hear a sentence we never heard before, we perfectly understand what's going on, if we understand the words. So this is because language consists of two parts. One is the meaning of words, and the other part is basically how these words interact together to give the meaning of a whole, say, of a whole sentence. And in fact, the last part, there didn't exist an algorithm or something like that until some 10 years ago to even think about what we humans do with these words in order to form the meaning of a sentence. So there was no theory, so no way we could teach machines how to do that. So that's, I mean, to give a metaphor there, you can think about quantum computing as having your states of your qubit and then your circuit you apply to it. And of course, what the circuit does is a lot more than just the state of a qubit. It's like a program, a process. And it's as if we humans didn't understand, knew what the qubit states were, but we never really knew what the circuit was. So there was no way we could teach it to machines. That's kind of the situation we were in. So it was you can't just blame it on machines. It was partly our fault that we didn't understand ourselves how we did the processing of natural language ourselves. We didn't know it ourselves how we did it. We just were able to do it magically.
And in your recent work, you've shown that natural language processing is quantum native. That is to say, it's something that a quantum computer is well suited to doing. I mean, just off the top of my head, I wouldn't have, you know, sort of thought that myself. Why did you come to that conclusion?
So, I mean, I had no natural language processing background some 10, 12 years ago, but a colleague of mine who was like a very established figure, his name is Steve Clark, he's now working at DeepMind. He had been looking into cognitive science work and other science work, and he saw that people started using some tools of quantum computing there in order to deal with making words interact in the kind of ways I was just describing. So Steve was my colleague. He was, in fact, in the same department, in the same corridor even. So we really start thinking about this problem. How can we combine meaning and grammar in one whole? So that's really, grammar is the way our words interact in a sentence, of course, because that's what we do. We put words together according to grammar. And when we start to look at the structure of grammar, which goes back like a long time, till Chomsky in the 60s, Alembic and Chomsky in the 50s and the 60s of the previous century, when you start to look at that structure, and then you look at the way computers deal with meanings of words, which is with vector spaces, just like in quantum physics, they use vector spaces too, then it turned out that the way in which grammar makes these words interact is exactly the same as in which, say, in teleportation, qubits interact with each other by means of measurements. It's exactly the same structure. The way you see this very concretely, that these structures are the same, is if you look at quantum mechanics in a very particular way, which is what we call categorical quantum mechanics, or which you find in my book, Picturing Quantum Processes, where we represent quantum physics in pictures. It's these pictures which are about composing quantum systems, which are exactly the same as the structures Chomsky and others came up with for language in the 50s and the 60s. So the way you make words interact is exactly the same way as you make qubits interact or other quantum systems in quantum processes. And that's why it's very natural then to represent these linguistic processes, grammatical processes, by means of quantum processes. And basically that was our solution for how to combine meaning and grammar, which was something people couldn't do. I can indicate how this, that everybody kind of knew this, that nobody really knew what to do. If you type a bunch of words in Google search, which is a natural processing device, you immediately realize that it doesn't understand grammar. It doesn't understand the way we humans form sentences. So you learn some different way of talking to Google by ordering your words in a certain way. You drop words like the and other silly words, and like you avoid uses of things like not, for example, because it would completely mess up your search. So we know how to do this. Now, it would be much better if we could just speak to Google as we speak to another human. And that's sort of why we needed to know how to combine meanings of words with linguistic structure, which, as I said, ended up being done basically in a quantum model. That's the easiest way to say that. The model, which the theory which combines meaning and grammatical structure, is very much like quantum theory and very naturally embeds in a Hilbert space formulation.
And so you've come up with this model, this model of quantum natural language processing, but you've also implemented it on an IBM quantum computer. Can you explain that implementation in simple terms, and what sort of results did you get?
So initially, when we did this quantum model, we were actually experimenting with classical machines, because nobody of us really was even thinking about doing this on a quantum computer. And my NLP colleagues, they were playing around with this, and they immediately obviously saw that it was a difficult thing to do, because it was a quantum model and you try to stick it on a classical computer. So that's the origin of quantum computing, really, one of the origins when Feynman realized if you're going to simulate a quantum system on a classical computer, it's going to be exponentially expensive. Same thing happened for us when we were trying to do this natural language model, this grammar-aware natural language model on a classical computer, it became exponentially expensive. So obviously, the first thing you want to do is stick it on a quantum computer, if there is a quantum computer, which there really weren't at the time properly. We then also looked at it from a more quantum computational perspective, and we saw that you also get quantum speedups if you were going to do this for many natural language processing tasks. And then in other work, in the same line, we saw that there are some other things which are not so good in standard natural language processing, where they use vector representations. And that is, for example, if you think about words like a lion, which is an example of a big cat, which is an example of a mammal, and so on, you can't really represent this very well by means of vectors. On the other hand, you can represent this very well by means of density matrices or von Neumann's mixed states. So these are other advantages you can do when you actually start putting this stuff on a quantum computer. Again, people have been working with these density matrices for representing language, meanwhile, on classical machines. But it's just very hard, exponentially hard. So that now that quantum computers are becoming a little bit more potent in what they can do, we effectively looked whether we could do these things on the existing quantum computers, which was not at all an obvious thing. So the current quantum computers, a very important thing about that is that you can't really stick your classical data, your big data, on a quantum computer like that. It just doesn't work. Just like it's very hard to get information out of a quantum system, it's very hard, actually, it turns out, to stick information into a quantum system too, as far as modern computers go. So what you really do is you train a circuit, the variables of a circuit, on your quantum computer. Now, in our case, this is a fantastic paradigm because the circuit itself represents the grammar. The variable represents the word meanings. So we actually just take the circuits, which is the grammatical structure, which is just sitting there in the computer for free, basically, and then we train the variables by means of some corpus. The most recent results we've been doing, we take like 100 sentences, which is a lot. So 100 genuine, full-formed sentences that we use to train the quantum computer to understand actually the meanings of words. For example, you got a story about Alice and Bob, and then by training these variables, the circuit learns stuff about Alice and Bob. He sort of forms a meaning. That's literally what he does. It forms a meaning of who Alice and Bob are, how they interact to each other, how they relate to each other, how they interact with other stuff. So it forms a worldview of Alice and Bob by means of this training. So once we've done that, so once in the circuit settings, this knowledge about Alice and Bob is there, then we can start to ask questions about Alice and Bob and whatever story is going on. So we did that. Of course, we're not asking questions which we actually gave the answer to already. We asked different questions, which possibly from the whole story and the context around it could be answered. And we always got correct answers. Most of the time. So there's a few things which you need to succeed in during doing. You need some sort of convergence, because ultimately the way you train such variables is by, well, you take a starting setting and then you do some classical optimization stuff. And this may not always converge. This may sometimes go wrong. But in our case, it worked very well. And then we got also the right answers for the questions. So it was a surprise that you could even do it, given the sort of resources classical NLP needs. And I mean, the size of the computers people need, the reason people are only doing NLP recently is really because it needs humongous computational power. The theory was there for ages, but it's really only recently that it started to take off because you need incredible computational power. So people may have been playing around with GPT-3 recently from OpenAI, but just to train that thing costs like $10-12 million just to train it. So it's incredibly expensive. It's obviously not something that can scale any further anymore because of this ridiculous expense.
So when will we see practical applications of quantum natural language processing? Will this require significant improvements in quantum computing hardware or in the sort of quantum algorithms that you're running, or both?
So personally, I think that with the computers which are around now, I'm talking about, for example, the large IBM ones and the Google one and the IonQ one. like one, I would say it would need one generation before we can actually do something meaningful on a quantum computer that you couldn't do on a classical one anymore. I'd say one generation more is enough to do something meaningful. Obviously, that doesn't really mean like practical, as in practical in the real world, because you really have only these few hardware devices out there. So it's not something you're going to do in the shop or something. But I don't think we're too far off doing something meaningful that you classically can't do. Now, that's not the end of the story. I think while we've got this quantum model, we need to much more fully embrace it, because it's one thing to try to use quantum NLP to do stuff you can do in classic, people try to do classically. But I think we should really become quantum NLP minds and see what sort of tasks, new tasks, are very, very natural to do with these sort of machines. And I'm, for example, I give an example of this. Like I've written papers about meaning of entire text, which is something which is not really considered in classical NLP. And I think that's a place we need to go, because that's something very natural to do with a quantum computer. Establish the meaning of a large piece of text or something like that. And that gives a completely new generation of NLP applications, really. And I mean, I can't say too much about that, but the sort of, just to give an idea of what this could lead to, this could, for example, lead to something of a automated diagnosis, or so a doctor has some data about you, maybe visual data, I don't know, visual representations, and then via question answering, an AI is trying to diagnose your disease. So that sort of NLP is not something you could practically do with anything classical. It just wouldn't work. It's too interactive. It's too complicated. It involves dynamical meanings. It's not something that seems to be on the cards in classically. And that's something which is very natural to do with these classical models. Very natural.
So, Bob, you've been an academic at Oxford for 20 years. What made you decide to move into industry?
Oh, that's a good question. There are a lot of, I can give a lot of different answers to, some more positive, some more negative. But to stick with the positive ones, so I've developed this line of work most of my time at Oxford, which was to understand how things compose in quantum mechanics, and which actually led to an entirely new quantum mechanical formalism, which is fully diagrammatic. That's the stuff you find in my book with Alex Kissinger, Picturing Quantum Processes. And most of my research group I built was around that. People following quantum computing may have seen something called ZX calculus, which is now gives one of the best compiler optimizations people get, and it's very good for other quantum software aspects. That all came out of this same new quantum formalism. It was, for a long time, it was a hard sell, this new quantum formalism. But now, with quantum computers really here, and we actually start interacting with them, it turns out that that stuff was actually really good, and is really good for practical quantum computing. And so it's kind of natural for me, after like years and years fighting in academia, to convince people just by telling them that it's good, to actually go there where you can actually show that that stuff is really good and it's the best way to go forward. So that's a very natural way to go. And as it turns out, I mentioned this ZX calculus, like the person I came up with it, Ross Duncan, was already the head of software at CQC, and was already integrating these tools in the ticket software compiler of CQC. Now I see an opportunity for me to actually go much further in AI, trying to use like quantum paradigms for AI, because the stuff I'm talking about doesn't end with natural language. It's much broader. It appeals to much more cognitive features and human senses and sensory interactions. So it's a much broader model, and it would help us much better understand human-like AI.
And so what will your job at CQC entail? Will you be doing, what people think of as academic research, or will the problems that you address be much more practical than when you were a professor at Oxford?
So I can tell, let me just say it, like, university admin these days is pretty horrible. So it's not just being academic there. You have to deal with a lot of not always very functional and competent aspects of certain entities of the university. And the grant writing process is also very cumbersome and it comes with a lot of complications. So what I've experienced now is like, I basically had to click my fingers like in the Avengers movie, and suddenly I had a 20-person research group to work with me in Oxford in our own building. So that's a lot more efficient than academia. And so we can actually spend a lot more time really seriously thinking about the problems and working on it. So one part of my role is like to run this team at Oxford, which we just started with our offices built and all that. And then,
so that's a CQC office.
That's a new CQC office in Oxford. Yeah, which we build it very hands-on to the extent that I help build the furniture by hand. So we were very hands-on with that one. On the other hand, I also have a global role within CQC, which is it's called the chief scientist role. And the role there is actually there are now many teams in CQC to integrate them better. Look for common foundations so that we can stay, that CQC can stay a science-driven company, not a business, of course, with the aim to produce business, but we want to stay a science-driven company. And so I'm going to then try to put forward the foundation for the sort of scientific directions we should do, of course, with the eye to then to also be a profitable business, of course. And I mean, in academics, it's kind of similar, you know, like, you do your science with the aim to become a grant awarding business, stuff that gives you grants, which is not necessarily the same as the best science.
Bob and colleagues have described their recent work on quantum natural language processing in two preprints that are available on the archive server. You can find links to both in the notes for this podcast on the Physics World website. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Thank you, Hamish. Sorry we couldn't do this over a beer.
Maybe in 2021 or 2022, if we're lucky. The ocean can be a very noisy place, especially in busy coastal regions where sounds from human activities such as shipping and oil exploration can drown out the sounds made by marine wildlife. To find out more about underwater acoustics, Physics World's James Dacey caught up with a US-based researcher who has studied sounds in the relatively quiet seas brought about by the pandemic.
The past year has been difficult for all of us in many ways. But one outcome has been the reduction of noise from shipping and other human activities in marine environments. It's created an extremely rare opportunity for biologists to study animal acoustics in relatively quieter oceans. To find out more, I caught up with Anna Shirovich, a marine biologist at Texas A&M University at Galveston. So hi Anna, thanks for joining today.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
So I suppose just to begin with the basics, I mean, I know that a lot of people might be aware that whales and dolphins use sounds for hunting and finding each other, but can you perhaps say a bit more about the cacophony of sound which is out there in the oceans?
Yes, of course. As you said, dolphins and whales are the ones that are most famous for being very vocal. But in fact, fish and even invertebrates make sounds as well. And they can be locally in some places very, very dominant. So for example, if you've ever snorkeled at any kind of warmish or even temperate location and you heard all of this crackling noise, when you submerge your head underwater, you've probably heard snapping shrimp. In many places, they're the dominant sound in shallow waters. Basically, what happens is they make little bubbles implode when they snap their claws. And so they use the fish and inverts use sounds for all kinds of important biological things, just like marine mammals do, for finding mates or defending territory or in some cases catching food. So it's a really important medium in the ocean.
Okay, I think we actually have a clip, don't we, from the Flower Garden Banks National Marine Sanctuary in the Gulf of Mexico. Let's hear that.
So what you can hear in that clip is the constant noise. That's the snapping shrimp that I was just describing. And then also you hear little buzzing-like noises, and those are fish. And I don't actually know what fish they are. We're still in the fairly early stages of trying to distinguish all of the sounds that we can record in the ocean to figure out what species produce them. But we know that often fish will make those types of sounds when they're spawning or otherwise aggregating with other members of their own species.
And so I know in your research, you're interested in the Gulf of Mexico and some of the human-induced noises, such as shipping activity. Could you perhaps talk about the extent of the noise within the Gulf of Mexico?
Yeah, so Gulf of Mexico is a fascinating place because it's a fairly industrialized body of water, fairly industrialized sea. And in Galveston, where I live, when you are standing on the shore every day, you can see a lineup of tankers that are waiting to go up into Houston Channel. And I it's my pastime to actually count those daily on my walks. And there's anywhere between 16 and 24 of them usually out there. And so these ships are constantly coming and going in and out of Houston, but also more broadly in Gulf of Mexico, the Louisiana and New Orleans. And so all of the ships, and in addition, there's Galveston, for example, is a cruise ship port. So there's constant vessel traffic coming in and out of that area, but also the Gulf more broadly. And it is one of the loudest oceans in the world that we have measured so far. And it's this consistent low frequency rumble. It's basically kind of like living next to a highway where you constantly hear traffic going by.
There's also sound, isn't there, from the seismic surveying? Is that something that has a wide impact too?
Yes. So that's another aspect of the soundscapes in the Gulf of Mexico is the prevalence of seismic surveys, which those surveys are conducted with air guns, which are towed behind vessels, and they're covering areas of the ocean, trying to detect what's underneath the seafloor to evaluate the oil and gas deposits underneath the seafloor. And the way the surveys are conducted is by firing these air guns, which again are implosions that are explosions that are happening that are producing low frequency, high intensity sounds that can travel really well over long distances. And so throughout the Gulf of Mexico, there is often some place where one of these surveys is taking place. So you hear air guns very, very frequently across the basin as a result.
Is there evidence that this human activity is having an impact on this marine wildlife that uses sound to survive?
There's definitely lots of evidence from all kinds of different studies. It's pretty hard work actually to demonstrate to what extent and how sound is impacting marine life, because many of these animals, they spend all their time underwater, so we cannot see them. And figuring out how their behavior is changing in response to sound, or even when there's any kind of physiological damage, is very challenging. And so it's a huge field of research that, together with many, many colleagues, we've been trying to chip away and figure out what are all of the different ways in which sound is impacting animals. Some of the common themes that we see is that in case of really high intensity sounds, animals can suffer hearing damage where they have impaired hearing for a while. Also, there's often displacements or animals move out of certain areas in response to sound, or may in some cases, change their vocalization, either their vocalization rates or the frequency, the pitch of their signals to get out of that noisy bands. And so it's a very kind of diverse and broad set of ways in which animals respond, which isn't really that surprising because we also respond to sound in many different ways. When you encounter probably loud noise, the context in which you are is going to impact what you do. So for example, if you are in a restaurant and you're really, really hungry and it's noisy, you're going to sit there and eat because you're really hungry. And so you'll stay a while and continue to feed. And we see that, for example, in whales, baleen whales, in response to military sonar, if they're foraging, they might stick around and continue feeding because that is more important than this noise, as a disturbance. But if they're not feeding, they will move and move away from that source. So similarly, if you're on a street, you're just walking down the street and there's a jackhammer, you might cross the street because you don't want to listen to that jackhammer as loud as possible. So
imagine that.
So there's a variety of responses, and often they're dependent on the context and kind of the circumstances that the animal is under. So it's a huge task to understand all of those bits and details.
I mean, to use your analogy, I mean, I guess one thing, you know, a human might do if you're in a noisy environment, say a restaurant, you might shout louder. I mean, is there any evidence that animals change the way in which they communicate as a response to this noise, you know, in addition to just leaving the environment?
There's some evidence in some whale species that they will change, like I said, they'll change the pitch or the frequency of their voice to get out of that noise. And speaking louder is something that is actually, again, it's another thing that's pretty hard to document because you would have to know what is the sound that the animal is experiencing, and you'd have to be able to measure the volume of the sound of the animal itself. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we need to be able to track the animal, or at least localize the animal and measure the sound at that animal to get the answer to that. So there's only really been one or two studies that have indicated that some baleen whales seem to do this. This is known as the Lombard effect, where you speak louder when you're in a, or a cocktail party effect, right? Where you speak louder in a cocktail party to get over the noise. But it's a really challenging problem to test in the field with these animals that are wild and that you don't know where they are and you don't know what is exactly the level of sound that they're experiencing.
We're speaking now in December, and obviously it's been a very, very tough year for everybody with the pandemic.
Right.
But I mean, one thing that emerged early on were lots of news articles about, you know, the fact that air pollution was dropping. And so there was kind of a slightly positive environmental story going on there. So, you know, this reduced human economic activity, has that also led to quieter oceans? Is there evidence of that?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting one too, because there's been some evidence of initially decreases in shipping as kind of global commerce just slowed down. But then another thing that happened is, as everybody stayed at home and had to socially distance, and we were trying to think of ways that you can still have some outdoor activity, is that small boat activities in some places have actually gone up. So what that does, the small boats sound kind of different than large vessels. They're a little more higher pitched and more squealy in a way than these big vessels. So the character of noise in many cases probably changed. But most of the data that a lot of us work with are these long-term recordings that are deployed, instruments are deployed for 6 or 12 months at a time. So we are just starting to recover those data and analyze it to see how exactly, what are the trends and what has changed. And I think there's going to be a lot of these fine nuances of understanding how exactly sound has changed. But one of the great things about sound as a pollutant is that when you remove the source of the sound, it goes away. It's not like CO2 that lingers in our atmosphere for a long time. We will be able to see on very quick scales, if there was times when shipping stopped and then maybe 2 weeks later, if small boat use increased, we will be able to see those kinds of fine scale trends. Because again, once, if the ship is not there, you're not going to hear it.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying, that, you know, it will be perhaps months or even years before, you know, you really have these studies published. I mean, are there any other questions that you would like to see addressed in these studies, looking at this, you know, as a really unique opportunity, perhaps in our lifetime?
Yes, I think the other interesting thing is going to be comparing the sounds that we're recording from animals and seeing if there are any changes in their distributions and movements, or if the animals are doing anything and how they're responding to this changed acoustic environment potentially. There have been stories also early on of dolphins that they were seeing, you know, up in Venice, in the canals of Venice, right? Mm. And so things like that, is this the year where we're going to hear animals in our recordings that we haven't heard before in places where we haven't heard them before? I think that would be an interesting thing. And the second part will be to see how much we can try to use these data to understand better how animals respond to sound. So maybe seeing something that's more baseline behavior when sound levels are lower, to compare it then to the times when sound levels are increased.
You know, in the short to medium term, these boats and these seismic surveys probably will return. So is there anything that, you know, this research that you've been working on for years, are there ways in which that can feed into industry to perhaps design ways of mitigating the impacts, you know, perhaps slightly quieter boats, et cetera?
Yeah, that's certainly the hope, is that we can understand better how animals respond to noise, so that then we can adjust our activities around it and try to reduce the impact. Quieting of vessels is certainly something that has been going on for a while, where the International Maritime Organization has been working with various other agencies and governments on figuring out ways how to make vessels quieter. And the seismic industry has been in studying alternative methods for exploring the sediment or the deposits of oil and gas that are underground, because ultimately they don't need all of this, what they consider higher frequency energy, which is tens of or 100 hertz. They don't really need that energy to be dispersed anyway. What they want is the sound to go into the crust. And so they've been working on developing technologies as well to try to reduce how much acoustic energy spreads into the ocean environment. So I think those are two parallel things, that the technological advancements and developments to reduce noise levels overall. But then even with that, our understanding of how animals respond in particular cases is going to be critical in putting in place mitigation measures that help reduce any impacts even further.
And is that quite common for, you know, perhaps people like yourself, a researcher, to work with industry or work with people developing technology, or at least be, you know, consulted from time to time for information?
There are a variety of different programs that provide funding for fundamental research, for example, that has been identified from the industry as something that is needed, something that can help understand impacts or other things. I don't work very much on the technology side, but I imagine that would be certainly a place where there's a lot of interactions between science and industry. But even in our realm, seismic industry or the Navy has specific science needs, questions that they need help answering to be able to implement their mitigation measures more effectively. And so I've worked in that kind of realm, where we provide just a basic science information that can then inform better policies and help industry and Navy and whoever else engages in business that produces sound in the ocean. It can help them mitigate their activities.
Okay. And just finally, I mean, has the pandemic itself, I mean, it's presented this opportunity for science, but on a practical level, has it disrupted your ability to actually go and do these studies, to do field work?
Oh, absolutely. It's been much more challenging to just to go out on the water, because if you think about social distancing and boats, it's really hard to do that. So there has been, initially when all the shutdown started, pretty much all of the, as far as I know, all of the research vessel activity stopped until measures could be evaluated and put in place. And so now, and this depends from institution to institution and university to university to some extent. But in general, if we're just going out on a short day trip, that can be allowed with potentially some paperwork that you have to fill out. But for any multi-day trip, you'd have to first go quarantine in a hotel for a certain number of days and then get tested and then be allowed on the vessel, where depending on situations, you again will be masked for some amount of time. And if your trip is only, let's say, 3 or 4 days, if you're going somewhere far enough offshore where you cannot make this a single day trip, you have to spend the night on the vessel. You could be spending a week in a hotel quarantined to go out on the boat for 3 days. So that's going to disrupt a lot more of your life than it normally would, right? So it's, you know, but we're all getting used to these new ways of doing business and trying to get things done. So, but it's getting on the water has been very challenging. And I think that's just another indicator or a show of how having these recorders that are out there autonomously collecting various kinds of data that we have through ocean observatories or just long-term instruments that can store data on board for months at a time. They're really valuable at times like these because they allow us to maintain our time series through pandemics and other things that get thrown in your lap that you don't expect. So there's some challenges, but I think we can still hopefully maintain a lot of the time series and use this terrible event to learn something more about the environment around us.
Okay. Well, thank you, Anna, for your time today. And yeah, I'm glad you're at least able to continue your work remotely, and hopefully you'll be back on the seas soon as well.
Yeah, thanks. We're all hoping for that soon, and that we can all go back to our normal lives.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast, which is brought to you by Teledyne Princeton Instruments Spectroscopy. Thanks to Anna Shirovich, Bob Kuka, and James Dacey for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. We'll be back again next week, but in the meantime, I can heartily recommend the most recent Physics World Stories podcast, which features a lively and passionate discussion about some of our favorite physics-related books, TV shows, and films in 2020. You can find this in the podcast section of the Physics World website or on leading podcast hosting platforms, including Apple Podcasts. Bye, until next week.
Physics World.